Hello and welcome to RTÉ Radio 1's The Rolling Wave podcast. Tonight on the programme, my guest is fiddle player Martin Hayes, who's chosen some music for us to play on the show. And we're going to start with a track from an album called All Ireland Champions Violin. Meet Paddy Canny and PJ Hayes with Peter O'Loughlin and Bridie Lafferty. And this album was recorded in Dublin in 1959 and later re-released. And it's a classic recording. And we're going to start tonight with three tunes from it, featuring the fiddle playing of Paddy Canny and Martin Hayes' father, PJ, with Bridie Lafferty on piano. Story of the making of that particular album first. Tell me that.
Oh, yeah. Well, by all accounts, the O'Neill brothers, who were from Clare originally, lived in the States, kind of had Dublin Records, I think was the company. And they originally asked Paddy Canny to do a solo, but Paddy didn't feel like doing it or was shy to do it or whatever the reason. But he was playing a lot with my father at the time. So they were kind of like a playing duo quite often. So the decision was that my father would come along with him and Peter O'Loughlin. And like they were friendly with Bridie Lafferty, who lived here in Dublin at the time as well. So that was kind of the configuration. It kind of came together like that, kind of loosely. It went from Paddy's solo album into this other thing. And I think the O'Neills hired a little, maybe double the time of the length of an album or something like that, of studio time. In other words, the idea was they'd walk in, play, and leave, you know. But sure, by the time things are set up, like they had only one track or something recorded, like, and after 2 hours, there was no, you know, they have only one track and they're supposed to have an album. So the studio became unavailable and they had to go find another studio somewhere in Dublin that day, which they did. But there wasn't any, they didn't have engineers per se, but there was some kind of assistant in the studio who says, well, I know how to plug in the microphone and get the machine going. He says, so there's just one mic and we'll set it up here and you can just kind of sit around and play and I'll just stop and pause and we'll record again. So they just recorded it. So it wasn't really engineered, but the musicians themselves decided like, in what relationship they should all sit to the microphone and recorded it. And the other thing about it is apparently, I don't know if this is absolutely correct, but some people have said it was the first long-playing record of traditional Irish music made in Ireland at the time. There might have been other ones made in the States, but this was the first long-playing record made here. But anyway, so there you go. But apparently they recorded a good number of other tracks as well on that day. And so anyway, we don't know what happened to them.
And the relationship between the two, I mean, they were very close. They weren't exactly the same age, but they were close, weren't they?
Well, Paddy was probably like, you know, maybe 5 years older than my father or something like that. Not a huge amount, like, but maybe when they were teenagers, it was quite a lot, you know. But my father basically learned from Paddy. And then the two of them just kind of used to play the local house dances and would kind of, you know, go from, you know, from one kitchen to a school somewhere and be playing little dances and stuff like that. And that led them to gradually getting involved in what was a Cayley band that became the Tulla Cayley Band, which was formed in Tulla in 1946 or something like that. So
coming up on 80 years soon enough.
Yeah, that's right.
And they had a joint wedding day, I believe.
They did. They both, like, well, Paddy married my father's sister, Philomena, and my mother married my father. And so Philomena, they had a double wedding. So Philomena left the family home place and went on, of course, obviously, to live with Paddy. And my mother moved in. Like, it was kind of like, I don't know, it all worked out somehow, you know. But they had a double wedding, yeah. So it was kind of, I often felt their relationship was like musically, like was a bit like what I went on to have with Dennis Cahill, I think, you know, this kind of like, you know, close kind of brotherly friendship in a way, you know.
And were they very different musicians, the two of them?
Radically different, actually. You know, their styles were quite different. My father was, I think he loved playing for dancers, and he loved rhythm and drive in music. So he was quite rhythmic in his playing. And Paddy was quite lyrical, and I think he probably would have never minded if he never played for a dancer, you know. So there was a kind of, like Paddy's was very lyrical, very dynamic, you know, very quiet, very loud, but it was very singy, very expressive, very nuanced. And my father was very kind of, I think, hearty and kind of rhythmic. But the two of them together, oddly enough, you know, was a really nice combination, you know.
And what for them constituted good music or very good music? What would they have looked out for?
Well, one thing I can say for sure is that they rarely talked about it in technical terms anyway. They rarely thought that it was dependent entirely on technique. You know, and I think most people actually know that there are qualities in music that are kind of difficult to pin down, difficult to express. But you know it when you hear it sometimes, you know. And it's mainly got to do with like kind of a quality of depth and feeling that comes from a person's playing, and like a level of sincerity and expression. And music that didn't have that was kind of, well, lacking, I suppose, in their minds, you know. But yeah, and so it was like Paddy and my father would have thought like that. But loads and loads of the old musicians were quite sophisticated in their understanding of that, you know, and their understanding of that as being a kind of a central purpose in music or a defining quality, you know.
And were they happy with that record, or what was that a record that was in your house then? Were they proud of it? Would it have been played?
You know what? I was probably about 8 or 9 before I heard the record, before the record was even in our house. I think they made it and just walked away. I think they listened to it at all. I know my father didn't have a copy of it. And I remember hearing it for the first time and thinking, like, I really loved it, you know, but it was kind of like incidental. Like it wasn't like we didn't actually have a copy in the house. So, you know,
it's amazing, isn't it? Well, they'd be amazed that we're still talking about it today.
Yeah,
And pleased, I hope. You mentioned the Tullagh Cayley Band, and your story is intertwined with the story of the Tullagh Cayley Band going way back. But tell me about these particular tunes, Johnny Allen's Real Sporting Nell, and then finishing with Toss the Feathers.
Well, Johnny Allen, of course, was a musician from Feakle in County Clare, and I think that tune would have been picked up by Francis O'Neill, whose wife, as it turns out, was from Feakle as well. So that's why we know he was around there, and he would have known Johnny Allen. And so, you know, Sporting Nell and Toss the Feathers would have been kind of eternally popular tunes. One's recorded, of course, by Michael Coleman, but would have been very popular tunes in East Clare at the time, and definitely were always kind of part of the Tullagh Cayley Band repertoire, I'd say, from the beginning years on, you know.
Cayley Band, I mean, your father was in the band, as you were yourself, but the business end of it also came through your house, I believe. Is that right?
Yeah, if you could call it business. I mean,
the engagements.
Yes, the engagements, yeah. Yeah, there was, like, we actually had letterhead, you know, like printed envelopes and letterhead. That was the only part of it that was business. But my father would take bookings. This was going back years ago before the phone. And like, so somebody would write a letter of inquiry. My father would write back and say, yes, we are available. This is the fee. Will you have a piano? And will you be able to provide a meal for the band? And if so, you can write a letter of confirmation. And a letter of confirmation was received and the booking was done. You know,
very efficient.
Yeah, yeah, that's how it works.
No
yeah.
nonsense, no yeah, messing.
Yeah, it was just yeah. So my father did that for many, many years. Yeah.
And how many gigs would the band have done, sort of a year?
I think, like, looking back at old diaries, like, in the 50s, I think, like, it, you know, in the 50s really seemed like the heyday, you know. And they were doing, like, 2 and 3 nights a week, you know, like, all year round, kind of, you know, like, except for Lent, you know. And, like, that was a strict kind of, no, there were no gigs, that was it. Like, it was a dry time for musicians, like, around Lent time.
Practice time.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And, but yeah, they would have done a lot. Like, I mean, the kind of geographic area that they covered was, like, you know, like, Galway, Offaly, Tipperary, Limerick, Clare, up to Mayo, as far as Longford, you know, down to Kerry, bits of North Cork, you know, but like it was that kind of geographic area. It needed to be such that they could drive home afterwards, you know. That was the main requirement.
Mayo to Fecal is quite a drive if you were
doing
that.
Oh, we did
at night.
It. We did it like many. I did it as a child with them, like, or as a teenager, I suppose, a young teenager. But yeah, we'd be like, you know, time for milking cows and we get home.
And tell me about the tea ceremony that was involved in yes, these tours.
Yeah, he lives in Tulla. His name is Matty Ryan. He was an accordion player, and he, like, when I was a teenager, he was the main man kind of in the band, and he was the driver as well. There were two cars. There was a kind of a West North Clare car that would drive, and an East Clare car that would drive to locations. But Matty, anyway, you know, liked his cars. He was a mechanic, and we had a drummer called Jack McDonald, and Jack used to bring a flask of tea and biscuits and for every night, you know. He was great, but Matty didn't want this going on in the car, you know. So Jack resorted to bringing a tablecloth and agreeing that we would have the tea and the biscuits on the bonnet of the car, you know, late at night after somewhere. We'd have to pull in and have tea, like, standing around a car. Like, there are loads of places around the country, say, that I can still recognise as, oh, God, I remember we used to actually pull there and, like, have the tea, you know.
It must have been quite a sight to see
I think so, yeah. I think so.
A tablecloth.
Like, how badly did we need tea and biscuits, like, that we were willing to stop the progress of getting home and, like, stop the car, get out, put a tablecloth on the bonnet of the car and have tea and biscuits.
Oh, the ritual is important. Yes, it's important.
Yeah, yes.
You were, I think, quite a young teenager when you started playing with the Tulla Paley Band. Is that right?
I was 13, you know, so that's the youngest teenager you can be.
Yeah.
And through secondary school, I spent the weekends with the Tulla Paley Band, yeah.
And, I mean, what was that like as an experience for, a young musician, but also, I mean, the age span of the band would have covered all the decades.
That's right, yeah. Well, yeah, it meant that you were actually forming friendships with people much older than yourself, you know, and they were kind of becoming your colleagues and comrades in a way, you know, which was, like, odd, I suppose, you know, that, like, that took up a large chunk of, quote unquote, your social life, you know. But it was great, and I loved being out with them, and I love getting to go places and play. I always found that kind of very exciting. And yet it was kind of also, you know, in the 70s. So it was kind of the beginning of the end of the Kelly Band era, you know. Well, it was actually the end of the Kelly Band era as such. Now there are Kelly Bands and Kellys and everything. It's quite popular again, but that it was revived. But what I'm talking about there is that, like, you know, there was the 50s, then the 60s, and then the 70s, and it was beginning to diminish in its kind of cultural relevance at that time, you know.
Would you have known that at that time? Would you have been aware of that?
Yeah, I would, yeah, I would. Yeah, of course, yeah. Like, yeah, you can always feel the loss of hipness. Yeah, absolutely. You go, yeah, this is not so hip, is it? Yeah, yeah, exactly, yeah. Well, you know, the Kelly Bands generally didn't wear jeans and sandals and T-shirts, you know. And the whole new folk movement that was growing up around us was a very culturally different kind of experience. So I found myself kind of on another train here. I wasn't with people my age who were kind of gravitating in towards this whole new folk thing. I was in a Kelly Band, like, with a shirt and tie and a blazer, you know. And so it was just a different kind of experience.
The Tulla play in, you know, a very unique style. I mean, on that track we just heard, you can hear that, the pull of that high D, say, in the second part of Toss the Feathers, you know, the lift, the rhythm.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, their style wasn't compromised at all for dancers or for playing in the ensemble.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't homogenous in any way. They just took their music and put it together in a group.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I would say, like, there wasn't a lot of rehearsal, but there was a lot of common understanding about, you know, what the tune was and where it was going and what was it about. And there was a kind of, like, the other thing that was happening in the Kelly band like that is that the continuing connection with the dancer and the dance was still there. And, like, after all, you know, when you look at O'Neill's collection of books, it says 1001 Irish dance tunes. So dance is a factor and a part of this music that I grew up with. And it can be quite exhilarating when a group of musicians get into the real swing and groove of a piece of music. And particularly so if you have good dancers who are equally into it. It's quite like the experience, really, you know.
Mm. And it must have taught you an awful lot about rhythm.
Yeah, it did, yeah. Yeah, rhythm. I mean, like, you know, I mean, it taught me a lot, but it's not something one can know so much as something one can sense and feel and get in your body, really. It's like it's difficult to think about. It's something that one has to, like, swing is swing, you know. Like the only way you can really know it is by lots of exposure to it, I suppose, you know.
Mm. Do you dance?
I did, a little bit. You know, wasn't great, because the vast majority of my time was looking at dancing, you know, like very little of it was spent actually dancing. But, I could dance a Clare set, you know, at the time. And even as a young child, I had done some step dancing as well. Like, so, yeah, with some sense
of it. It's there in the feet. The next track you've picked, it's Tony McMahon and Noel Hill, and they're playing The Humours of Castle Finn. And this is probably one of the best live albums of traditional music. Tell me about your own connection with this record.
Well, the tunes, for example, like The Humours of Castle Finn, is like on the record that my father and Paddy Kenny made as well. Well, Tony McMahon, like, you know, was like a huge presence in my young life as a musician. I adored his playing pretty much from the moment I think I first heard it. You know, I loved it. And I feel that in Knock na Gree, that album captures a kind of a spontaneity and an aliveness and an overall atmosphere surrounding this music that's rarely captured. I don't know if it's ever been captured as well as it was captured on that album, I think.
Live albums. I mean, I love live albums because they capture a moment in time, but you do have to be able to sit back, don't you, and let things go. I mean, you don't have the control, obviously, that you have in the studio. Is that liberating or is it nerve-wracking or what is it?
Oh, I think we'd all be better off learning to let go and not to get trapped in attempted effort in creating something perfect, you know. Like, I mean, perfection is kind of the enemy of spontaneity in a way, you know. Yeah, mistakes are irrelevant. Like, I like live performance because, like, I can make a mistake, and I will, and I regularly do, but I have to let it go instantly and move on. Whereas one can start nitpicking in a studio to the point of, like, distraction. I mean, the other place I learned about, like, kind of live recording was working with Padre Oreja on that series of albums, like, with Truer. You know, it was like we would record a tune, like, I'd say, in 10 minutes after I actually knew how to play it. And we would record it. And the first time I would get that right, that would actually be the recording. So there was zero going back. Like, it was just kind of like you felt relieved to actually be able to play the tune, and the next thing it was on the album, you know. And so that's how those recordings went, you know.
And is that good or bad, or is it better if you have time to inhabit the tune? Because a lot of the tunes you play are tunes you would have known all your life.
Yes, yeah. There's arguments for both of those points of view, I think, and they both have their place. I do think there is something good about spontaneous playing, where you just let it be and stop fixing it. I mean, how many bands produced a demo tape to go into the studio to produce an album not as good as the demo tape? You know, like, that would be a common situation, I think. And then there's also the tunes that one knows for, like, an entire lifetime, and they have kind of marinated deeper within you. And you have a different kind of relationship with them, a different kind of freedom. But then they also, like, can benefit from, you know, a spontaneous playing where you simply, like, I am surprised sometimes that I can play a tune that I know for 50 years and, like, all of a sudden have new things happen in it after 50 years. I go, like, why did it really have to take that long, you know, for me, this idea to occur, you know? But it does. And that is one of the great beauties of the music, you know, is that some of the tunes, if they're good in the first place, they're good forever, you know?
And I suppose the other thing that you really hear in Knock and Agree with Tony and Noel, and you hear it on any good live album, is that it's a conversation between Noel Hill and Tony McMahon in this case, plus the audience and the dancers. It's the whole that
it's
you're
the whole,
capturing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's the whole. Yeah, that's what's so good about that particular album, is it kind of captures the social setting. It captures the dynamics of the conversation between the dancer and the musician, and between the musician and the musician, and between the musician and the music, and the dancer and music. You know, it's a lot of kind of relationship that's kind of all captured in just a moment. And there's a lot of information in it, really, you know.
And Tommy Potts, the dear Irish boy. You knew Tommy Potts, didn't you?
Well, I suppose you could say that. I mean, like, I was a very young fellow when he used to come to the house. It'd be more accurate to say I remember him, you know. You know, he spoke of a kind of a depth and seriousness in music, you know, that was kind of very obvious and very kind of, like, almost frightening, you know, like when I was young, you know, when I was gone, that, like, it was a very heavy thing, you know. But yeah, I do remember it, like, being a very serious night of music, and just basically the entire family sitting listening to Tommy play for an entire evening, which, when I think about it, I'm going, like, what an incredible privilege that was, you know. But it was amazing, yeah.
It's interesting that, because when other visitors would have come to your house, because I think you had kind of an open house, people used to call.
Yeah.
Would you have played with those people as opposed to listen to them, or was
you
it a
would,
different?
Yeah, I mean, you would have done that, of course. Like, that was normally turned into a session, but it was a different occasion when Tommy Potts turned up, because Tommy was, like, a very unique musician with a very unique way of playing, and because there was a sense that, like, it was more important to listen to him than to play with him. And I remember from my father and from those musicians of that generation, they weren't as avaricious about, like, let's all play together and go to the session, let's play all together all night long. Like, my father really wanted to hear other players. They wanted to hear the uniqueness of individual players, and they wanted to hear them play tunes on their own. And I know they wanted to hear Tommy Potts play, you know.
County Clare was so important for him. He really felt sort of welcomed and protected, I think, in County Clare. What was it about him that people, you know, liked so much, that they got so much what he was doing or what he was trying to do?
Well, there were like some individual musicians in Clare, I suppose, at the time that he would have known. There were very serious kinds of listeners to music, you know, people like Padraig O'Loughlin and Sean Reid, and, you know, my father, and lots of great players that knew that there was a deep soul in the music, like, that was important. And Tommy, of course, was that, like, personified in a way. So he was kind of revered and held in very, very high regard. And I think when he came to Clare, he kind of could feel that. He could feel the the respect for what he was attempting to do musically.
And as a fiddle player, would his music have been a companion to you when you were learning and growing up, or did you come to it later on?
I came back to Tommy Potts later on in my life, but I had a memory of how he played, and oddly enough, I could continue to hear a certain flavour of that in the way Paddy Kenny played also. I think Paddy was quite taken and influenced by Tommy Potts also. And it was later on, years later, when living in Chicago, that I kind of circled back late one night in a friend's house after a night of music. And I was to sleep on the couch, and I rifled through the record collection, finding the record of Tommy Potts and playing it quietly by myself in this house. And then suddenly it was as if like all the music, there was a kind of a vague memory or recollection suddenly became very much alive. And then the other thing I later on understood was that when he was recording that album, it was in the 70s. And so it was roughly around the same time when he was coming to our house that I remember him. So it was very much that repertoire that's on the Liffey Banks. That was the kind of thing he would play on a night out. And so I think I had a kind of a buried memory of it that kind of later on came to life when I was living in Chicago. And then I began to feel like Tommy Potts was the greatest of all the musicians, really. You know, something quite profound compared to so many, I think, you know.
Mm. You've chosen the Dear Irish Boy. Why the Dear Irish Boy?
Well, one of the things you'll notice there is that, speaking about spontaneous music and that kind of thing, is that like in the first bar, there's a squawk, like something goes wrong with the bow. And this happens regularly to any musician. It can happen easily enough, you know. And if it happened that early in a tune, you know, any other musician would simply stop and say, let's do that again. Not Tommy Potts. And nor did he obviously say, I will go and record that again. I get the feeling that playing that air was in itself an event, an unrepeatable event, something that he worked himself up towards, and that was that. And I just think, God, the lesson in that is quite profound in a way, and the egolessness of it, and the dedication to the deeper quality as opposed to the superficial little squawk. It tells you where he saw this music, what he felt it was about. You know, because like none of us would want to let that squawk pass. Now we would, you know, like it's, you know, and because we're all too smart now, we know how to fix that immediately. Mm. But I just love that what we hear is Tommy Potts going all in to the experience.
Mm. Tommy Potts, the Dear Irish Boy. Well, we have a song now, which is interesting. Dárach Ó Cathain, Donach Ó Bán. Why Dárach? Tell me what you like about Dárach Ó Cathain.
I just like the sound of him. I like the sound of his voice. I like the guttural tones that come out of his voice. Like, you know, I'm not a native speaker. I have very, very, very limited Irish, actually. So it's not about that. But even when songs are in English, I rarely hear the words, never mind Irish. I always am hearing the voice of the singer. I'm hearing the sounds. I'm hearing the tones. I'm hearing the feeling. I'm hearing the phrasing. I'm hearing, you know, like his soul in a certain sense. And I think, like, I will regularly recommend these tracks to students or to anybody interested in Irish music, because I will say that, like, all Irish music contains two things. It contains a song and a dance. Like, there's a rhythm, there's a pulse, and there's a song. And you can, like imagine almost any expression of this music having some measure of that all across. So I feel like that the relationship of our music to the human voice is an important relationship. I also feel like that, like Connemara Shannos is by definition an old expression and an old depth of feeling in our music that I think anybody who plays this music needs to listen to. Now, there was an argument that you couldn't play these airs unless you could actually sing and understand the words, and that the words would inform all the expression. But of course, like, Willie Clancy is one of the finest slow air players ever, and he didn't speak the language. And like, you know, I got this from listening to like Pakistani singers like Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan, and going, I don't need to know what he's saying. I don't. He's riveting me, and he's going right through me with his singing. So I have that feeling about singing. It's how I hear singing anywhere. Mm. So Darracha Cohan makes all the sense in the world for me as a musician, you know.
Well, let's have a listen. The song you chose from Darracha Cohan, Donacha Bán. So let's have a listen to that. Darracha Cohan singing Donacha Bán. The next track that you've chosen is Martin Wins and Austin Tierney's from Frankie Gavin and Alec Finn. Yeah. The interplay between Alec and Frankie is just brilliant on this record. Tell me, first of all, why you came to that, and then we might talk about that partnership.
Yeah. Well, you know, like, by all accounts now, and I haven't really checked this out with Frankie, but from what I did hear, it was recorded very spontaneously also, like kind of like an afternoon, you know. And like himself and Alec are obviously like closely bonded. And the other thing was, like, when I did hear it, I was going, oh my God, he's doing everything the opposite of what I think I should be doing. Like he was like looking at like an inverted version of, oh yeah, he plays hard, I play gently. He digs in, I'm looking for soothing sounds, you know. It was all this kind of like, at first I was kind of stunned by it, you know, like, what was this? But it's really, it's a beautifully warm album. It's spontaneous, and spontaneous in buckets, you know, all over the place, you know. Like, the playing is just so alive. It's so free and so full of energy. It's just, and of course, like, I have a nostalgic relationship to it as well. I can remember hearing it on that little record player, you know, and like hearing the warmth of it, and yes, the hardness of it and warmth, the things that you didn't think could be happening at the same time, you know.
And, you know, as somebody, like, I mentioned that partnership, because it's very much an Alec and Frankie record, you know. Different person, if Frankie had been with a different person, it would be a different record. But as someone who plays and has played with loads of people over the years, that kind of musical connection, is that at that level, at that depth, is that rare or is it easy to achieve?
I think it's rare enough, you know. I mean, it can be achieved, obviously. I mean, the one thing I think, like, with Alec and Frankie was that the way Alec played that kind of offered the maximum freedom to Frankie. Like, Frankie had all the support of the way Alec filled in the beautiful sound and tone and things. And with the kind of minimal intrusion and interference in how Frankie would play. So Frankie had the support and all of the freedom on top of it, you know. So it was ideal in a way, you know.
And it's a little bit like the kind of the musical relationship that you would have had with Dennis Cahill, where there was it was about space and leaving space for you or for the melody or for Dennis as well.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, in a way, like, you know, because a very different kind of sound, maybe a very different concept, but the relationship being, I think, equally deep and important, you know, in musically and personally, you know. Thank you.
was Frankie Gavin and Alec Finn. Your final track, I should have asked you to pick 20 more.
We could have
added a lot more in, but they're such great music in each of them. And of course, the full albums are there for people to listen to as well. We're just picking one track here and there. But Mary McNamara, you've known Mary McNamara pretty much all your life, I think.
You've
played together a long time. How did you get to know each other?
Well, like, Mary is from like the little town of Tulla, you know, which is not all that far from where I grew, but it's 7 or 8 miles. But 7 or 8 miles wouldn't be too much in ordinary circumstances. But from where I lived, it would be 7 or 8 miles almost straight down a hill, you know. And like, so that was 7 or 8 miles back up a hill, you know, after you got to Tulla. So you didn't really want to do it. Like, so Tulla might as well have been New York, like, at some time for me, you know. But nevertheless, I think it was a sloga competition, and I think we were in Spanish Point or something, like, when I met Mary for the first time. Well, I met her before, but when we actually decided, let's take out the instruments and play a tune. And like, almost straight away, there was kind of empathy and a connection and an ease with which we could play the tunes, a kind of like as if the swing was something that was common to both of us, and the way we wanted to phrase the tunes felt natural to both of us. So neither of us had to compromise how we played, really, to play with each other. And that was a very joyful experience. And I think maybe, you know, other than playing with my father, the first time in my life that I had really experienced that, you know.
And would you have played together then a lot over the years?
As teenagers we did, yeah. As teenagers we played a lot. I played a lot with her brother Andrew also, who was quite a different player. Like, he was like a strong rhythmic player and loved to play for dancing, and, like, you know, it was a somewhat different style than Mary. But I think when I wanted to play the music that was kind of more soulfully connected to, you know, how I wish to play, like when I'm by myself, you know, or something like that, then, like, it was really, there was a compatibility with Mary there that was unique for me at the time, you know. And it always kind of made me aware of the quality of musical relationships I wanted to have, you know.
Well, you chose The Fisherman's Lilt and My Love is in America. Is there anything you'd like to say about these particular tunes?
Well, except that I know that those two tunes I remember playing when I was about 14 or 15, when I used to play with Mary, and we played those together in that order. And so it's kind of like, you know, a little memory of my early years playing, I suppose.
McNamara and Martin Hayes, and I think Seamus Quinn is on piano there,
right, yeah.
The Fisherman's Lilt and My Love is in America. Well, Martin, thank you very, very much. You know, going back over these records, I mean, I do this occasionally where I ask people to pick tracks, and I think it's exceedingly difficult because on a different day you might choose different music. Generally, when you're listening to music, would you go back to these records, or does your listening ear go towards other traditions when you're listening to music?
Yeah, my listening goes in all kinds of directions, but I do come back to a lot of this stuff. These are the kind of the formative recordings for me, the foundations in a way. And there's plenty of other things too. The other thing that I have as well that I still hold on to is like old, you know, cassette recordings that I've maybe since digitized of like house dances and parties and people playing and stuff like that. So I have that. So I go back to that every now and again. The other thing about those recordings is that in the course of teaching or recommending to other people or getting people to understand this music, I will very often use these recordings as a good example. Like I will always recommend like Dara Cuchahán. I will always recommend Tommy Potts. I will always recommend Inneach na Gcrí. You know, and I'll say, you know, like, even with that three there, you'll have like fundamental information about like the depth and quality of this music.
And definite nourishment in all those, for sure. So listen, thanks so much for coming in to us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to RTE Radio 1's The Rolling Wave podcast with me, Aoife Nic Cormick. For rights reasons, the music tracks in this podcast were shorter than the original broadcast. So if you'd like to hear longer versions of the music tracks, you can go to rte.ie/radio1/The Rolling Wave. Until the next time, Gura Míle Maithigh agus Slán.